things you wrote when you were writing about the sex scenes of Lydia Yuknovich in The New Yorker. So I wanted to read a couple things you said and see if they spark any further thought. And hopefully I won't read a typo this time. So you said, "For Yuknovich, extreme experience, which includes rough sex, inebriation, pain, and making art, offers access to a self that precedes or exceeds the rational. It submerges her characters in the corporeal and instinctual, bringing them to what she calls the brink of animal. In such a state, violence can be, quote unquote, productive of beauty." And you add, "Yuknovich's sadomasochistic sex scenes also owe a debt to Michel Foucault and his notion that consensual, ritualized sexual violence can affirm the limited being and the limitlessness into which it leaps."
Lydia Yuknovich is one of my favorite living writers, and I think one of the best writers we have right now in English in writing the sexual body. And I am inspired. So I was writing that about her work in general, but especially about The Small Backs of Children, which I think is just an extraordinary novel, a novel I'm teaching this semester at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I do think Lydia is working in a philosophical tradition that's adjacent to but slightly different from the tradition I feel myself working in or aspiring to. And I don't know, it's funny, I've never tried to articulate to myself what that difference is. I know that for me, S&M, and as I think about S&M as it exists in queer contexts, you know, I do think it's a technology of transformation. And I think it holds out the possibility of drawing a frame around something, creating an aesthetically charged space, which I think the space of an S&M encounter is, and within that space, allowing us to fully engage with that part of the human apparatus that I think much of the time in much of our lives we are told we must repress. I think we can engage with a desire that multiple characters in Cleanness voice, which is the desire not to be. I think one can engage in shame and in an attempt to transform that negation, the negation of shame, the negation of the desire not to exist. You know, I think a lot about what it means to, as part of the sexual production of pleasure, to make use of violence, whether that's physical violence or whether that's the violence of language. And, you know, I think there are simple arguments made about that that are not easy to dismiss, but that I think are wrong, which is that the use of violence, verbal or physical, obviously within this sort of aesthetically charged space that is sanctioned by consent, that is a perpetuation of that violence. I don't think that's true. I actually think it might be something that gives us an escape from the perpetuation of violence. I think violence always wants to be perpetuated. I think the sort of default is for violence to perpetuate itself. Something that seems very true to me is an idea of the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, who articulated this idea of the principle of the conservation of violence as a way to explain how, say, a kid who is bullied at school comes home and bullies his younger sibling. You know, that idea that when we experience violence, we immediately seek an object to pass that violence along to. Well, what happens in S&M, it seems to me, like if I can take a word like faggot, which was a word that, you know, my father used when he found out I was gay and I was 14, and a word that really is a kind of scar in my life. If that word, if I can create a context in which that word is placed in the mouth of a lover, and instead of causing me grief, gives me access to rapture, then that seems to me really like a kind of remarkable strategy of survival, a way not to pass that violence along, but instead to transform it. And I do think one of the things that I find endlessly inspiring about queer people is that queer people are geniuses of transformation. And I think, you know, one of the ways of understanding the history of queer art is one of taking stigma and turning it into style. One of the ways of understanding the history of queer politics is one of taking stigma and turning it into solidarity. And one of the ways of understanding a history of queer desire is that of taking stigma and turning it into pleasure. Mm. And that was part of what I said to preface at Tin House, this story, The Little Saint. So Gospodar is a story in which that technology of transformation that is an S&M encounter doesn't work. And when I wrote that story, I knew it was really important that I write a story in which it did work. And in The Little Saint, the narrator has an experience that I think delivers him into a space of radical possibility, and one that has taken shame and also his own potential for deriving pleasure from violence and transform that into a kind of remarkable affective experience of another person, something like love, and also something like joy.
Well, when I think about this desire to not be, and also some of these paradoxical ways transformation can happen, and then back to the line of Foucault, the limited being and the limitlessness into which it leaps, it feels like it veers into the territory that almost feels mystical or quasi-religious. So I was hoping maybe you could speak about the apophatic or the via negativa and what those are and how they relate to your work.
I am not a religious person. I'm very much, very assertively, affirmatively, joyously atheist. But religion and religious thought has been very important in my life. One of my earliest literary obsessions was with Saint Augustine. And the via negativa, or negative theology, mystical theology, is something that sort of sank into my writerly DNA very early on. So the sort of Cliff Notes, very simplified version of apophatic theology, is it comes from a paradox. And the paradox is precisely that of trying to create a meeting point between the limited and the limitless. So Foucault was also a student of the mystics. But I do think it's just a fundamental sort of problem of human life. Like, we are these limited beings who are able to imagine limitlessness. And so we're always trying to find out ways to get them to meet. The incarnation is one attempt to theorize such a meeting, this limitless being in a limited body. For apophatic theology, the issue is that God is limitless, language is limited, and therefore we cannot say anything about God. We cannot make any statement about God that could be true, because any statement about God would limit God. And so one cannot say God is X, Y, or Z. One can only say God is not X, Y, or Z. But then that creates a problem, because of course that limits God. And so one can't say God is not X. One can only say God is not not X. But then that's a problem. One has to say God is not 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 X. God is not 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 X, etc. So what's fascinating is that this creates a syntax. And I do think it is more for me, inspiring as a kind of linguistic phenomenon than it is as a logical phenomenon, as a phenomenon of reasoning. I mean, it's an attempt to reason beyond reason, or, you know, the mystical writers will talk about unreason, right? It's an attempt to think about impossible things. And it's an attempt to take something that seems like an impasse, an irresolvable dilemma, finite humanity, infinite God, how can they meet? And it doesn't resolve or solve that dilemma, but it makes it mobile. It makes it productive. One can infinitely say not, 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 not. And there's a way that it generates a kind of energy. So it does a couple of things. One is it keeps things in motion. So instead of something just being a dead end, it keeps turning, not, not, not. And there's a way in which, you know, you keep coming at a problem from different angles, sort of hoping somehow, you know, what seems like a closed door will open. But also it becomes generative of an extraordinary energy. And of course, the goal of the mystics was what they called divine union, was an experience of ecstasy. And mystical writing, which has this remarkable syntax generated by all this, not this, not, not this, not, not, not this, is often, I think it's a kind of launch pad. It's an attempt to sort of generate a kind of psychic energy that can launch one into that divine union. And it can be extraordinarily beautiful. If you read Meister Eckhart, if you read Marguerite Porrette, I mean, these, if you read Simone Weil, I mean, these are gorgeous writers. I mean, so it's productive of beauty. And that is really useful for me. The problem for me is not God, but when I look at human life, I see a set of double binds. One of the principal ones, as I experience my own life, being that it seems to me part of the human, that there is something in us that desperately desires to be clean, and there is something in us that desperately desires to bathe in filth. And that is an irresolvable dilemma. There's no way to sort of think your way out of that. You know, the way that culture has approached that dilemma is to valorize one of those desires, the desire to be clean, and then to insist that the other desire be brutally repressed. And whole systems of thought and feeling and legislation have been predicated on that idea of repressing. Well, it is clear to me that repression is always a recipe for disaster. Instead, this mystical tool, technique, the via negativa, is for me inspiring because it suggests a way not to think of solving these dilemmas, but instead kind of inventing linguistic devices, inventing a syntax that can allow us to dwell in it and that can allow us to make it productive, to make it productive of beauty, of affect, in a way that, you know, the promise of mysticism is that somehow one does break through the double bind, somehow one does find the infinite in the finite, that somehow, you know, and this is how, like, lots of contemporary philosophy, like lots of what we call deconstruction, is just this mysticism sort of brought into the present day. This idea that whenever we have a dichotomy, whenever we have good, bad, clean, filthy, male, female, that always within one of those apparently monolithic ideas, one finds the other. And I hope what this book does, what cleanness does, I hope that finally it insists that actually in cleanness we find filth, in filth we find cleanness. And that in negation, you know, that story Gospodar It begins with the narrator saying, I want to be nothing, I want to be nothing. And it ends with the line, composing as best I could my human face. Somehow, in this experience of intense negation, he arrives at what seems to me like a remarkable affirmation.
We've been talking today to Garth Greenwell, the author of Cleanness. So maybe to reiterate a little bit of what you've just said, in other places you've traced a path from apophatic theology through Heidegger to Judith Butler, all of whom aim to destroy binaries, not explore them, but destroy or explode them. And it also reminded me of something you said in your essay about the Hanukkah film, the piano teacher that you wrote for Criterion. The juxtaposition of refinement and rawness, discipline and release, culture and degradation is the thematic and narrative engine of the film, which works finely, like Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, a book the film recalls, to dissolve these dichotomies. And when you talk about how Cleanness, the book, is aspiring to explode or destroy binaries, it also feels like Cleanness, the concept, or the aspiration to be clean, is the opposite in a way. So there's a certain paradox I think you're working on there. Is that right, that cleanness isn't a good thing in this notion, that cleanness, which a lot of people might think of as good, is actually in this notion something that is troubling and needs to be troubled?
I think cleanness, you know, which obviously can spur us to acts of great moral value, I would say. But I think when we become over-attached to a sense of our own cleanness, our own purity, our own righteousness, it's the most dangerous idea in the world. And the title is an allusion to a medieval English poem by the Gawain poet, the poet who wrote Gawain and the Green Knight, which is a retelling of Bible stories, one of the most important among them, that of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that is cleanness. You know, what it means, you know, that nightmare vision of cleanness, which is just wiping the slate clean, which is utter destruction. You know, that is the kind of cleanness, or that's the nightmare vision that haunts the whole book. You know, and I do think I see that everywhere in human life, the danger of our desire for cleanness. I see it, you know, one of the places where the book is most interested in exploring it is in the relationship between shame and a rhetoric of pride. You know, the rhetoric of pride in queer contexts is, I think, a life-giving rhetoric. You know, it was so important for me when I was 14 to see a pride parade. But if pride becomes a coercive rhetoric, if we become so attached to a rhetoric of pride that it becomes impossible to acknowledge or explore or talk about shame, then I think that's devastating. And if we become attached to a sense of ourselves, which is, you know, a sense I've battled in my own self, that, you know, that somehow there is a true, authentic, pure, clean self that predated the filth of homophobia, that the filth of shame, that somehow, you know, there is, preceding the moment when my father called me a faggot, that there is a true self that somehow, that then, you know, that word poured filth on, and that if only I could clean that filth away, that should be the goal, to clean that filth away and reclaim some authentic self, I think that's deadly. You know, I mean, the wound that word was for me when I was 14, my self formed itself around that wound, grew around that wound. There is no me without it. Queer people are born, still are born, even more so were born 40 years ago, into a world where homophobia is the air we breathe. There's nothing else for us to make ourselves out of. And so I think it's deadly to be attached to an idea of cleanness. Instead, I think the challenge is, and this is, I think, maybe the deepest question or theme of both of my books, what do we do to this thing, with this thing, that inalienably belongs to us? You know, what do we do with the fact that we are beings formed by lessons of shame that we know were bankrupt, were false, but that, you know, we will never get to be selves who were not taught those lessons. So then how can we make it productive? How can we make it not just something we run from or something we repress or something we deny, but instead something that we can make, again, productive of sociality, productive of beauty, productive of pleasure. Like that's one way in which I hope the book is trying to think beyond these binaries and is sort of refusing what I think is the deadly idea that purity exists.
Well, to stay with cleanness and apophatic theology and quasi-mystical notions, if we jump from Gospodar, where our narrator is submissive, to the story Little Saint, which you've talked a little bit about, where he's in the far less familiar role of being the dominant. The man you call the Little Saint has perhaps turned promiscuity itself into a saint-like virtue, almost a radical act of hospitality, where his own existence is only there for others. And I was hoping you could talk about the Little Saint in this light, this gesture that the Little Saint is making, and whether you see this gesture as apophatic or not.
I think it probably is apophatic. I mean, I do think the contrary of this deadly version of cleanness for me, its opposite, is promiscuity. And promiscuity to me is the great human virtue. By promiscuity, I mean the delight, the pleasure, the excitement we take in mixture. And, you know, I urge promiscuity on my students in their reading. I urge promiscuity on my students in their art making. You know, this idea that tradition is never pure, that tradition is always a hybrid thing, that great artists use everything. You know, Shakespeare is the most promiscuous writer. I also think promiscuity is a great virtue in sociality. You know, I think communities are stronger for being diverse. I think cultures are stronger for exchange. And for me, promiscuity is also a virtue sexually. I wanted in The Little Saint, and not just there, throughout my work, I wanted to take seriously sexual practices and sexual communities that queer people and especially gay men have invented that are almost always only derided. The sociality that gay men create through cruising, through sexual promiscuity, is, I think, almost universally seen as morally unserious. It seems to me deeply wrong. You know, the extraordinary networks of care that emerged in the 80s and 90s in the face of the early AIDS crisis emerged precisely from queer sexual communities and queer communities of chosen kin. ACT UP was an outgrowth of these sexual communities. It was also often a manifestation of these sexual communities. You know, when you read something like David France's book, How to Survive a Plague, one of the things he wonderfully conveys is how much cruising took place at ACT UP meetings. Like that was part of what allowed them to survive, the joyfulness of that was produced by these communities. That just, to me, utterly refutes the idea that gay male promiscuity is morally unserious as a form of sociality. I did want to take seriously the idea that promiscuity could be a discipline of radical hospitality, by which I mean hospitality in that grand sense, which invokes the question, how does one engage with the other? What is our responsibility to the other? You know, I think when I started writing the story, The Little Saint, the title came very early. It's a play on the name of this character, which we don't learn his name, but we know that the root of it means light, which is the root in Bulgarian and Slavic languages generally of many words associated with sanctity in the church. And so the narrator's nickname for this man becomes Svetchito, the Little Saint. And I think, you know, I knew this was going to be a chapter that was going to be one of these 100% pornographic, 100% high art chapters. And I think, you know, I think I thought the title was a little ironic at first, that there was a little frisson, this guy who wants to do very dirty things being called the Little Saint. But by the end of it, it was clear to me that the title is just 100% earnest. And that, in fact, this man lives a life of extraordinary integrity, extraordinary moral integrity. And is that apophatic? Yes. You know, one of the things that he makes part of his moral practice, his practice of engaging with the other, is an insistence on unprotected sex. He knows the risks that that entails, and takes them on himself. That is an apophatic discipline. It's a discipline that the narrator feels very complexly about. You know, it's something that it's not something that he easily sort of approves of, although I hope that, you know, where they arrive at each other, the question of approval or judgment just doesn't apply. But it is, he has sort of decided that certain values are more important to him than his survival. And I do think that that is one of the prerequisites of saintliness.
Well, it was a great pleasure having you on the show, Garth.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
We're talking today to Garth Greenwell, the author of Cleanness from FSG. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Women's March, Sunday, March 1st, from noon to 3 p.m. at Portland State University South Park Blocks in Portland. Portland Women's March is a rally committed to advancing political and social change to create an inclusive safe space for women and their allies. Again, that's Portland Women's March, Sunday, March 1st, from noon to 3 p.m. at Portland State University South Park Blocks, 1436 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at KBOO.FM. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features artists who will be performing at this year's PDX Jazz Festival: Branford Marcellus, David Sanborn, Kenny Barron, Miguel Zenon, James Francis, and Kenny Garrett. The program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium. It can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on Audio, then Podcast, and then scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
The time is 12 noon here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.